We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
Go on without me. Just go!
A good soldier never leaves a man behind.
Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness.
Life, finds a way.
Welcome to Silver Screen Biases. Each week we pick a movie off of IMDb's Top 250 and dig into it. We're examining truth claims in critically acclaimed movies, while also examining our own biases. I'm Nelson.
This is Jeff.
And this week,
The Passion of Joan of Arc.
This episode is brought to you by our community on Patreon. They make this show happen, and you can help. Links to our Patreon and merchandise are in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Happy second week of the new year.
Happy second week of the new year.
We should greet each other that way every week this year.
Every week of the new year.
Happy third week of the new year. Happy fourth week. Happy 52nd week of the new year. No,
happy 51st episode of the podcast, Jeff.
Yes. Yes. We are a fifth of the way done.
Yeah.
One fifth. We're into the second fifth.
Second fifth.
It's incredible. We'll probably do more than 250. Because of the fluctuation of movies that are on and off, and then we've, like...
Yeah.
I hope we do more than 250.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, doing 250...
Right.
We're fifth way there.
We're one out of five of 250.
Yes. I love it. I love it. So for every five movies you've watched, we've probably watched one of them.
Yeah.
That's math. Movie math.
List five movies you've seen... And Jeff and I have probably watched one of them.
Yep. How about them odds?
Yeah.
The Passion of Joan of Arc, man.
Passion of Joan of Arc.
Silent film.
Is this a prequel to The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson?
Yep. Had nothing.
Actually, I guess it'd be a sequel because Jesus came first and also kind of is involved in this story.
Yeah. Yeah. She very much... portrays a Jesus type character in the film, a martyr type.
Yeah, I would say from the historical record, she's more similar to the judges of Israel,
yeah,
than she is to Jesus of Nazareth.
I'm out of my territory when it comes to like saints and this era of history.
Yeah,
and honestly, even her specifically, like right. I remember knowing her name. And like, I remember hearing about her growing up and stuff, but like, this was unfamiliar territory for me.
Before this, everything I knew about Joan of Arc, really, I knew because of Age of Empires 2, Age of Kings. Joan of Arc was one of the campaigns.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah. But it was all like the military stuff. And I'd never really given much thought to, is she who she says she is? And that's really kind of one of the focuses of this movie. And I watched a documentary. I think maybe she is.
She was not a fraud.
I don't think she was a fraud.
What's your thoughts? Sort of odd topic before we get into more specifically her in the movie. What's your thought about saints? Just the idea of saints in general.
Well, so she wasn't a saint in her lifetime.
Right. But she was deemed a saint afterwards, right?
Yeah. Like, she was...
sainted.
Sainted. In just ahead of World War I, I believe. This movie was made in the interwar period. The director was invited by the cinema ministry of France to come make a movie. And he had a handful of different French characters that he was considering. Marie Antoinette was one of them. And he settled on Joan of Arc because she was kind of in the zeitgeist at the time.
Ah, the zeitgeist.
And that, like her being in the zeitgeist, was really a result of hundreds of years of people trying to clear her name from the record, right? Because of what we see in this movie with the fraudulent trial. It's a kangaroo court show trial. And then she got granted sainthood by the Catholic Church, and then she became the patron saint of France. Perhaps one of them, I don't know. We're not Catholic. We're not really into the whole veneration of saints thing, so I don't know that whole process.
And that was kind of what I wanted to lean into. Was just like what as I'm not Catholic now, nor have I grown up Catholic.
Right.
Like, it's like I'm unfamiliar for my whole life.
Yeah.
Like, the idea of sainting something seems odd.
Yeah. But there were people...
And I want to say respectfully, if we have any Catholic listeners out there, like, please tell us, like, if you've got any more information. Like, it's just like, do the saints help with your specific journey in faith when it comes to you following what you believe when it comes to Catholicism?
Yeah.
Like, is there a direct line between how you interact with your faith daily when it comes to what the saints have done? Like, just versus, like, us as Christians and just the life of Jesus.
So the saints in Catholicism play a few different roles. The first role is, in order to become a saint, actually, there has to be a miracle. And performed isn't quite the right word, but like a miracle that the saint was involved in.
Right.
Because Catholics don't believe that it was the saint that did it. It comes outside of the saint, right? Just the same as we do. So there has to be a miracle. Actually, interestingly, the Catholic Church requires at least one priest to be involved in this research before sainthood to disprove that it was a miracle. The further back the miracle happened, the harder it is to prove.
Makes right? sense.
Yeah. Or to disprove. So, but she was granted sainthood, so the Catholic Church was satisfied, at least, that there was, in fact, a miracle performed. If you look at, like, the military stuff and, like, a lot of what she said, it falls pretty closely to kind of a lot of the same language that the judges used, and a lot of those same bizarre military odds and things like that. Like, one of them was, she told King Charles, hey, there's a sword I'm looking for, and it's behind this specific altar in this specific church that she'd never been to before. Can someone send someone to go get it? I really want that specific sword. It belonged to a hero of France. Of a couple hundred years earlier. And they go, and lo and behold, there is the sword. That's just the way the story goes anyway. You know, skeptics would say all kinds of things about that. But mm-hmm. the sword was there. That's the sword she carried. A lot of bizarre stuff. A lot of, like, social norms being upset, for example. Like, the fact that she was dressed as a man was part of why she was on trial. But in that time, for a woman to follow an army meant that they were a prostitute. And
yeah.
So her dad didn't even want her to leave the farm.
Yeah. Don't leave the farm, Joan.
So, but to go, yeah. yeah. but he was a lot more he refused to let his children learn to read or write. He beat them mercilessly. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. But
so he has good standards.
Yeah. But to get back to your saint question, like, what is the role of the saints in the Catholic Church? So once they're venerated as a saint, usually they will be given, like, a domain. Like, this is the patron saint of travelers. This is the patron saint of bakers. This is the patron saint of whatever,
they
of France.
They become mascots? Like, not to say that disrespectfully, but, like, but do they essentially become, like, the image of a category?
In a
like,
way.
They're the front man.
In a way. They play two roles. Woman. There's two kind of tiers of veneration of saint. One is, this person represents what we should all strive for in this area. So if he's the patron saint of travelers, this guy represents what it means to be a good traveler, and also how to interact when people treat us poorly while we're traveling, people treat us well while we're traveling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're examples. Yeah, so they're supposed to be like people that we aspire to be like in this specific area. And then the other tier, which Protestants criticize as being pagan, and I'm inclined to agree, is not a deification of them. They don't look at them like gods, but they will pray to those saints and ask those saints to pray on their behalf, to intercede for them. And it has to do with, again, so like if you're traveling, I don't know who the patron saint of travelers is, but it's just a good, easy example. You would pray to the patron saint of travelers and ask him to intercede on you as you travel. That's something that we as Protestants take huge issue with because
Jesus is our...
Well, like Jesus, God, and the Holy Spirit, right. The triune.
We have direct connection.
That's what we pray to.
Right.
And we don't need to pray to people to pray for us.
Right.
We can ask friends to pray for us, but that's different than communing with saints.
So saints are similar to like... And again, for our listeners, like I am coming into this very ignorant, so please please correct me if I'm wrong on this. Like, I want to know more. Saints kind of, in my mind, from what you're explaining, are the same thing to like in like Oriental religions and stuff, like when they pray to the ancestors. Like, is it similar like that too? Like,
no,
they're praying for them to like they want the ancestors to intercede for them. Is it similar in that way? Like,
it's something like that. It's kind of like a mixture between that and the way I see it as a Protestant, right? My Catholic friends are gonna probably get frustrated with me for saying this. If you venerate saints in the way that you pray to them and ask them to intercede for you, that to me is closer to pantheon like of gods, right? Like, so for example, you and I have both read Percy Jackson.
Yeah.
Right.
Speaking of which, this series is coming out. Actually, this episode will drop in the show will still be on the Disney Plus show. Very good.
Yes,
very I agree. Good. I'm enjoying it. I'm actually reading the second series of books right now as well. The one where it gets into more Roman gods as well.
What's so that? The Heroes of Olympus?
Heroes of Olympus, yeah. So
when you finish that.
Yeah, I'm on House of Hades. As of recording this episode, I'm on House of Hades. The last book is Blood of Olympus in that series.
And then are you going to read the one that was released this year?
The new one that goes back to the original Percy Jackson series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to read. That's next.
That is. The series you're reading right now takes place over the course of a year?
Correct. Correct.
The new book that was released this year.
The direct sequel to the 5 Percy Jackson books, yes.
Is that series from Percy's point of view.
Really?
And then there's another one coming up, which I think is going to be Trials of Apollo from Percy's point of view.
Really? Because
Trials of Apollo also takes place over a single year. Yeah. What I think it is.
I'm intrigued. I did not know the synopsis of the new Percy book that came out.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all I know about it.
I knew it was in the I knew it was more connected to the original 5 books, the first 5 books.
Yes.
But that's all I knew. I thought it was like I was just thinking it was book 6.
So,
that's fun.
And I think the reason that he did that is more than just I'd like to revisit this from a different point of view. Hyperion's owned by Disney. Hyperion publishes the book. I think that, you know, when Rick Riordan sat down with Disney and said, "Hey, we're going to turn this into a series." And they're like, "Great, we're going to do one season per book." He looked at his catalog and he's like, "Hey, when I get to Heroes of Olympus, I've done one book per like few months of the year. That's not going to do well for television. I'm going to keep Percy the main character and look at that whole series from his point of view." So that turns a 5 book series into a 7 book series, yeah. and gives him more Disney Plus time. I hope I'm right with that, not just because I like being right, but because I really want 7 seasons. Yeah. That'd be great.
This show has been
watch great. This actor grow up in this role.
Love the cast. Now the actor that plays, we're getting a little off topic, but this show's worth talking about. Zeus.
Have we met Zeus in the show yet?
Not in the show yet, but he passed away.
Oh, did he?
Let me bring up his name.
But I promise people, this will be relevant to the Joan of Arc conversation, and we're going to pivot back to it here in a second.
Lance Reddick.
Is that your cousin?
That'd be sweet.
Is it spelled like yours?
No, Reddick. He passed away March of 2023. He's in John Wick. He's in...
Can I see a picture of him?
The Black Lady.
I think I know
Man
who this
of Fire.
Is. I think I know
Godzilla vs. Kong.
Was he in Fringe? Yeah, he was.
Okay. So yeah, he passed away, and he plays Zeus in this series, so they will have to recast him.
Hold on, we're going to go to IMDb and get his top 4, like, what you know him for roles.
Yeah.
John Wick, John Wick Chapter 2, John Wick Chapter 3, and White House Down. I would say that Fringe is probably one of his best-known roles. Okay, so the reason I bring up Pantheon of Gods, Percy Jackson.
Yeah.
Who is the god of the harvest in the Greek gods in Percy Jackson?
I don't know.
I'll give you a hint. Mr. D.
Oh, Dionysus,
god of the harvest.
Also
god of wine.
Yeah.
Because they would harvest, you know.
Yep.
So in Greek mythology, Dionysus, god of the harvest. So if you wanted a good harvest, you would pray and venerate Dionysus. In Catholic theology, if you venerate saints in that way and not just see them as this is a person to be like, if you see them as somebody that you pray to and ask them to intercede on you, you might pray to Isidore the Laborer, a Spanish man who is a patron saint of the harvest.
Is there biblical context? Because like I know Catholicism, I know Catholics use the Bible. So like I know there is a connection. We share the Bible between us and Catholics.
Yeah.
Protestants and Catholics. Is there biblical text that
supports
is
this.
The basis for saints?
So in this situation, this type of veneration of saints is far more about tradition than any amount of theology you'd get from reading the scripture directly.
Okay.
And that's why, as part of Martin Luther's 95 thesis, he talked about sola scriptura.
In his march on DC, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Where, like, the basis of what we believe, if it cannot be substantiated from scripture alone, then
it has fault.
Then it has fault. So the more Calvinist wing of Protestants call this sola scriptura. The more Arminian might refer to this as prima scriptura. The two mean the same thing. But yeah, so that level of veneration of saints, I think, I don't see any justification for from scripture alone. Paul does talk about the saints. The way he uses it, it seems to mean anyone who...
It's gone before him.
Anyone who is saved
is
the saints. Some of the saints are now sleeping, he says, right? But like, if you are in Christ, you are a saint. And so actually part of this trial was to determine, is she even in Christ?
Mm-hmm.
Because they whether they truly believed that she was a Satanist, or if that was merely...
Satanist.
Because in the trial, they talk about, you know, like, you serve the devil. Whether that is what they truly believed, or if this was because they were defending their political positions, and we'll get into that once we actually get into the episode, is something else. And in that way, there is something similar to Jesus, where the Pharisees, the ruling theologians of the day, accused him of being in league with Satan. But let's
get into some facts.
Let's get into some facts.
All right. Passion of Joan of Arc, 1928. This movie was released in 1928. You and I watched, and I know you have some thoughts about this. This is the first thing we talk about here. You and I watched the version that was an hour and 36 minutes long.
That's right.
On HBO, there's a version that runs about an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then on IMDb, it actually states the length of the movie as an hour and 56 minutes.
That's right.
What's the situation with that?
Who's our director?
That was going to be my next thought. Carl Theodore Dreyer. And just to finish this little sub, this movie was passed.
Yeah.
The rating of this movie is passed. So,
yeah.
So, yes, that's the first little section of nuggets there.
Yeah. So, Carl Theodore Dreyer was invited to France to make a movie. After this one, he was never invited again by that. Part of the reason why there are different versions is that the original version that he cut was lost. Similar to...
was it Metropolis?
Metropolis. The only movie we've done older than this one.
Right.
So the original one was lost. The IMDb one, which is the shortest, is where all of the stuff that the...
Longest. IMDb is the longest.
I thought you said...
IMDb has it as an hour and 56 minutes.
Okay.
HBO was the shortest at an hour 20, which was the Criterion edition.
And what did we do?
An hour 36.
Okay, so somewhere in the middle. So the shortest, the Criterion edition, that's the one that has certain content cut from it as requested by the Catholic Church and the government of France. A little ironic, given what the movie's about. Now, the IMDb one is the longest one.
Yeah.
In the 80s, I think, they found in Sweden, a friend of Dreyer's used to run a asylum there, and in the janitor closet of that asylum, they found the full uncut version. It's believed that Dreyer had sent his friend a copy, and that's why it was there, but they found it. So that's probably why the IMDb one's probably from that one, and then we watched somewhere in the middle. So I don't know what content we missed. But if you watch the Criterion edition, there's some content that we got that you didn't. But if you want the full one, I believe what we have linked below is the full one.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do my best to make sure that that's the longest.
And I do know something else, because obviously this being a silent film, and this is French.
So yeah, it's all French cast.
French cast and French script, like French writings.
Yeah. And okay. When I could read the lips, they were speaking French.
Okay.
But the director is from
Los Angeles. No, I'm just kidding. Hollywood.
The director was Danish.
Danish.
Okay. I said Sweden earlier. Ooh,
I love a good Dane.
He's a Dane.
Yeah.
Where are the Danes from? Denmark.
Daneland.
Daneland.
Daneland. Another part in this movie that varies.
Yeah.
Is the music.
Yeah.
So the version we watched, they used the song "Voices of Light"
okay.
by Richard Einhorn. But other versions.
Oh, the guy from Ace Ventura.
Finkel is Einhorn. Einhorn is Finkel. Oh, we got to do that. We got to do that eventually on the Off 250. Oh, it's such a great movie.
Speaking of Off 250.
Yes. Well, yes.
Coming out this Friday.
No. But.
Never mind.
But. Will they have a chance? Will they be voting right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
We should have mentioned that last episode.
Yeah. If you're a Patreon subscriber, now's your chance. The voting is out for you guys to decide our January episode.
Yeah.
So vote now.
What are our options again?
So yeah. So listeners, if you're listening right now.
And you are.
And you are a Patreon subscriber. Yeah. If you're listening right now.
And you are.
And you are.
If you're listening to this as this episode comes out.
And you're a Patreon subscriber, go right now and vote on your three options for January's Off 250 episodes, which is.
Thank You for Smoking. Hot Fuzz. Wag the Dog.
Yes. So go vote now and then come back. Or
that's right.
I think you can do it while listening.
You can do this
while listening. You don't need to pause.
Yeah.
Don't pause. Don't hit pause.
But vote on one of those three, and that's the movie that we'll cover. You have 1 week before we close voting. So yep. and then Jeff and I will be watching that movie.
Watching.
And that's available to Patreon only.
Yeah.
So if you are not a member of our Patreon, you're interested to vote on that and hear our thoughts on
and movies. And suggesting movies.
That's right.
And suggesting movies.
Run, Don't Walk, and do that now.
So, other songs have been used as the soundtrack to this movie, but the most one is that "Voices of Light"
interesting
by Einhorn. So that's another variance.
So it's one song remixed throughout the movie.
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah. As you stated in 1927, we've done the movie Metropolis. So this movie came out in 1928. So this is the only other movie that we've done within this time frame, give or take a year.
Right,
or so.
Right.
Nelson, is this movie based off a book?
Yes, in an interesting way. So it's not specifically based off of any book. What it's based off of is the actual recording of the trial.
That's awesome.
The book that they show you at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
That book.
That's cool.
And a lot of the
transcript, essentially, right?
Of the trial. So a lot of it, there's some artistic, you know, a lot of the dialogue and who said what is directly from that. They did eliminate some people from the record just to keep it more contained.
Yeah.
And it took an 18-month trial and made it feel like it was like a 2-day trial.
Yeah.
And then the director, Dreyer, spent close to a year and a half to 2 years studying this trial. So that he could faithfully recreate it in film. However, if, like me, you are interested in learning more about Joan of Arc after watching this, I did some research. Joan of Arc, A Life Transfigured by Catherine Harrison, linked below, is one of the more like, hey, this is the book to read if you
definitive
want.
Definitive collections, yeah.
So I intend to read The Life of Joan of Arc, according to Catherine Harrison.
What years in history was the story of Joan of Arc? Like what timeline was this? Does this story take place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, basically, when she was roughly 17, she left home.
Okay.
When she was roughly 19, she was tried and executed.
Right.
She doesn't know how old she was, and nor does anybody else.
But what year of the Lord of Arc father?
So this would have been 1431.
1431.
So 1428 to 1431, really, is when she was doing her thing.
And this took place in England?
France.
France. Okay, this was
France. At the time, France was under English occupation.
Okay.
And she had a message from God telling her that he was going to use Charles VII to liberate France from British rule, and that it was her responsibility to help with that. She reportedly didn't menstruate during this time, which was evidence of her kind of like being set apart for a special purpose. Mm-hmm. She, in the writings of men that knew her, they didn't find, like, they knew her, they lived with her, they worked with her. Even when she wore dresses, which the movies kind of imply that she didn't, even when she wore dresses, they didn't, even though she was beautiful, they didn't feel any carnal desire for her, which is interesting. So the people that knew her very much saw her as kind of like this saint-like figure.
Yeah. Set apart.
King Charles the VII was set, his mother claimed that he was a bastard. Okay, and an illegitimate heir. So he was kind of full of self-doubt. And the first time they met, she brought him into like this side room. They spoke for a few minutes. And when they came back out, he's like, she told me things that only God could have known. She's the real deal. Let's go do this. Mm. And she, a woman with no military training, couldn't read, couldn't write, led armies successfully against the British.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable thing. Liberated France in 2 years. Something that kings had been trying to do for several generations before King Charles.
Right.
So there's a lot to this story that, like, when I started to look into it, and I haven't read like a thorough biography, I've watched documentaries now. It's like, hey, a lot of this is very familiar to the kind of stuff that we see in Judges. Maybe she was the real deal, you know? I'm very curious about that.
Was she on trial with the French?
She was on trial with the English.
With the English. Okay, so even after, they won...
Through the papal courts.
The English went back and said, hey, she's the reason we lost. Let's put her on trial. Like, so how did that come about? Like,
she
if
was on
they lost, if their connection with England was...
Yeah, she was
separated.
She was on trial by England.
How did they get access to her?
The English were the ones that were pressing the trial. The things that she was charged with was heresy. So something that the English crown didn't have authority to press her on, but the Catholic Church did. And this is still during not the Holy Roman Empire, but you know, the Pope had more authority than any of the kings did.
Mm.
And so the British sought out cardinals and theologians in France, friendly to England, to try her.
Compadres.
Yeah. So, like the Pharisees, these theologians had a corrupt incentive, power incentive, to maintain their position. And if King Charles takes over, they lose some of their power. So that's kind of what's going on there. And they represented a government far mightier than even the French government, even though they were in France,
because
mm-hmm. they represented the papal government. This is one of the reasons why the separation of church and state is so important. It's not just to protect the state from the church, it's also to protect the church from the state.
Mm-hmm.
When you get those two things mixed up, there's so many perverse incentives that really corrupts good theology, good doctrine. Because the corrupting influence of the state, none can resist. So, well, one can resist, and he did, but
right.
And they killed him for it.
Notable cast. None. You and I were not familiar with any of them. Just one note I do have about Maria Falconetti.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned that Joan of Arc was 19 when she was executed. Maria Falconetti was 38 years old while portraying this. So
that's right.
She was double the age of Joan of Arc at the time. So I just, that's,
but she was believably in her 20s.
Yeah. She believably looked young. And I think the lack of makeup, she had a very younger looking face.
Mm-hmm.
Her haircut obviously was also, it was hard to tell an age with the lack of hair and stuff on her head. So yeah,
And then she had a somewhat, suspicious death.
Maria Falconetti?
Yeah.
I don't know this. What's up?
So after filming Joan of Arc, Falconetti continued her career as a producer of light stage comedies.
Right.
Which surprised me.
And that's where she came from.
Yeah, that's what she's known for, is light stage comedies. After filming Joan of Arc, Falconetti continued her career as a producer of light stage comedies, appearing with the Comédie Française. During World War II, she escaped from France, first to Switzerland, Brazil, and then for Buenos Aires, Argentina. Falconetti had suffered from mental illness all her life, and in 1946, she died in Buenos Aires, Argentina, an apparent suicide by a self-imposed restrictive diet after having become significantly overweight. Her remains are interred at Montmartre Cemetery in Paris. Section 16. Her gravesite is not listed on official maps. Her grandson, Gerard Falconetti, also became an actor.
Hmm.
Now, I mean, what's exactly suspicious about this.
Yeah, like a lot of actresses and actors have dietary issues or like eating issues, you know, like, so that's not uncommon even today.
But
having actors and actresses having eating issues, disorders, of course, there's the word I'm looking for.
But if you go to her Wikipedia page and the opening paragraph, it says subsequent mysterious and enigmatic death. So there's not enough detail on the Wikipedia page that makes me go, this is suspicious and enigmatic. But I guess there's more to it that's not listed here.
Interesting. 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb.
That's right.
It stands right now at 218 on the IMDb Top 250. Do you have the history on this movie?
Yeah, so it debuted in the Top 250 in April 2001 at 215.
Okay.
It climbed as high as 138 in May 2003. Before rapidly dropping off the top 250 in December of the same year. It returned October 2010 at 240 and then fell off again in July 2012. Returned again in August 16 at 124, its highest ever, and it's slowly fallen to its current position.
Mm-hmm. 98% on the tomato meter, 93% audience. So pretty high marks there. What was the budget for this?
7 million francs. In 1928.
That's a lot of francs.
Which is the most expensive European movie at the time. I found a really cool site that allows me to convert historic currencies. And it even allowed to convert, like, what was 1928 francs to USD in... the most recent it'll do is 2015. But I decided to do, just give me the same time, and then I'll use the St. Louis Feds.
Right.
You know, the estimated currency conversion and the estimated inflation comes out to about 5 million USD today.
5 million today.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the so majority
not a
of that,
lot then.
No.
No.
But also, that tells you just how it's interesting that 7 million francs is worth, in 1928, is worth 5 million today. That's just how much, like, how much inflation was in their money. But the really interesting thing is that the majority of the cost of this movie was the set construction.
Yeah.
They made a castle.
Yeah. Which you don't even see in the film much, except like at the end.
Yeah.
Like most of the movie, at least with the version you and I watched, like
is inside.
Most of it is inside, and it's mostly close up face shots.
No. Yeah.
Like very, you see very little of the set.
But that is the castle
for the whole film.
That's the castle they made for it.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah.
So
this movie very much felt like a state. Like I was watching it on stage. Like yeah. I thought I was watching a theater production.
But it's also the era of film where it's mostly, a lot of the silent era is just stage productions
right.
with a camera behind it.
Peanut gallery notes?
According to our listeners, our Patreon listeners specifically, no, it would not be in their top 250. Either that or just, no, they haven't seen it.
Okay, there you go. Okay, before we get into some of the themes and stuff, the biases...
Yeah.
What'd you think of this film, Nels? Just overall. Was this your first journey with it?
This is my first time watching it. I thought that the acting, her acting, especially considering like what she's known for is comedies, I thought her acting was incredible. I didn't love it, but it did make me want to go back and learn more about Joan of Arc, which I think is one of the big goals of the movie. And so in that regard, I think it's very successful in what it sets out to do.
Yeah. I did not enjoy this film. All the things that I saw in reviews and stuff after watching it, I try to save influence until after I've seen a movie, after sure. I watch a movie for the first time. Like, so after watching it, I went and watched some YouTube videos. I read some articles and stuff. Like, the reoccurring theme was her facial expressions, which were great.
Yeah.
But like no different than what I've seen in some modern films. Like,
oh,
like,
I agree.
Like
I agree.
She didn't exceed in facial communication
that
I've never seen before. It's like, so in general, like there was nothing in this movie that set it apart from something I've never seen before.
No, I agree.
And
I would say that her the sadness that she portrayed felt very real.
It did, yeah.
I felt like I was like it felt like I was, you know, I felt there. Yeah. I felt it was good. But yeah, you're right. I think it was probably incredible for its time.
Oh, absolutely. So just like it's nothing from, and again, this is
like if we compare it to what to Metropolis.
Metropolis.
Right? I would say that the acting is far better in this than it was in Metropolis.
I'd put them equivalent.
Okay.
Cuz like and I even ranked them on myself like right next. Yeah. I put them right next to each other. Like they were communicating with their body, and I think you can only do that
hot
to a certain level. Like right. You max out. Like yeah. Like and I think both movies had top marks within that type of thing. Her face specifically, Maria Falconetti.
Falconetti.
I thought she was great, but like it wasn't anything that I'm going to be thinking about after we get done talking about this podcast. Like
sure.
Like compared to other actresses, I feel if modern actresses had to go do a silent film, I think they would do it just as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some, not all. So yeah, I wasn't blown away by it. I was nothing from this movie. I'm walking away with going, okay, I appreciated that. Like I can see why people like this, but for me, it's just like it was underwhelming. Now there is one part in this film.
And I think that's a really good example of why, even though it's been out for the entire life of the top 250, it's only been on the top 250 about half the time. Yeah.
I get it was ahead of its time back in the day, but like mm-hmm. I don't think that alone is reason for it to still be iconic.
I think its position in the Criterion collection makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. As films that have definitively changed the way films were after it came out. It changed film when it came out.
Yeah.
But as far as like modern film and what it has for modern filmmakers, I think, again, I've never made a film, so I could be completely wrong, and I'm okay with that. But there's nothing I've pulled from this film that I haven't seen in other things. Mm-hmm. One scene though, after watching it and then going back, then reading it, I'm glad I didn't know this until after.
Yeah.
The one scene where they poke her arm for blood.
Yeah.
That's real.
It's sprayed.
Nelson, that's real.
Ugh.
It was not Maria Falconetti. It was a stunt double, but
I could barely watch it.
It's so dangerous.
I could barely watch it. And I was like, man, that is incredible practical effects.
That was real blood.
But
I was like,
but that's too much blood coming out. That's not real.
That was real blood. They
I don't like that.
Accurately hit an artery and then sutured it up. But that's that was insane. Real blood. I wouldn't be able to watch that scene going back.
I wonder if that guy's still alive. Well, no, he's definitely not.
Yeah. None of the cast is alive anymore.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How long did he live after?
But yeah, that scene freaked me out. Retroactively. Yeah, that was real. So kudos to that, I guess.
Oh man.
Take that, Saul.
I wonder if that would fly today.
Oh, no way. No.
A body double.
Actually doing self-harm?
Yeah.
On screen? No.
But if you have medical professionals there,
I mean, I guess, is it different than someone taking a real punch to the face? Is it the same as someone doing self-harm in that way, just not breaking
But it's screen? Not self-harm.
No.
It's allowing harm to self.
Right.
It's different.
It is.
He's
different
because that was somebody else is doing the needle, and I would be shocked if they didn't have medical professionals standing by.
I don't know what their laws and practices and their protocol was in the 20s.
Let me ask you this:
but
do you think that there should be any laws prohibiting that?
I feel like this question is a trap.
You know where I stand.
Yeah, like you don't want laws at all. You outlaw.
That's close enough to my opinion.
Okay, most recently we saw, was it Alec Baldwin who shot someone?
Yeah.
Was it Alec Baldwin? Like, okay. Like, yeah, that's a tragedy.
Yes, it is.
And from what I know of that situation, that was not Alec's fault. That was the prop master's.
I believe that the courts haven't. The courts have ruled that it was not his responsibility.
Right. Like, so again, and I'm so far removed from the situation that there's probably details I'm missing. But in general, it, even in 2023, we're having issues where on set, casualties happen, body harm is happening.
Yeah.
And
well, here's where,
not rules, but there should be regulations on how things are done, like restrictions. So, which I know restrictions, I guess, are rules.
Let me comment on that, because I think you're making a really great case. And in any industry, there's always best practices. And then there are often within those industries, companies who their whole thing is, we come to your company and we teach your best guys best practices, right? So that's like the way markets regulate that kind of stuff. So the armorer on set, their responsibility is to know all the guns, what they're capable of, that they're not loaded, and that gun safety is being practiced on set.
And in most cases, they're the only one that's directly touching them, right? Like, they're the ones handing them to the actor.
Except for the actor, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're the ones that are directly, yeah. No one else touches that stuff.
No one else touches that stuff. And only ever blanks.
Yeah. Yeah, so why was there loaded ammo?
And then it gets a little weirder because of what you can do with cinematography, guns are basically never pointed at people.
Right.
I would point it I'm not even going to point it at the camera. I would point it at a mirror, and the camera's catching the mirror. Because it's not even a loaded gun, but we need to take absolute precaution.
Absolutely.
So he picked up a gun, aimed it at a co-star, and pulled the trigger.
Yeah. They were not blanks.
And I don't care any of the other context. If you do that, you are responsible for what's exited that gun. If you didn't check that it's empty, and you pick up a gun and you point it at somebody and shoot it, he's already violated all of the protocols, and he'd know these because it's not the first time he's operated guns in a movie. He's entirely responsible. Even if it's just manslaughter, it might not have been murder. He might not have had anything against him. He was just being an idiot on set.
Okay, change the situation.
So to go back to, do we need laws about this? No, because we have industry best practices. And then when things happen, there's still somebody responsible. Let's say that he had followed all the instructions from the armorer, well, then it's the armorer's fault, right?
That's where I would lean. I would lean on the person whose responsibility is to be in charge of the guns. Right. Like, say it's food. Like, say Alec Baldwin, the piece on set was a sandwich.
Yeah.
And he goes to eat that sandwich.
And he picks up the sandwich, pulls the trigger, and kills somebody.
Right. And that sandwich has salmonella or something. And now, it's like, I think in the same situation, like, Alec Baldwin is not going, his job is not to go and check that sandwich and make sure it's healthy.
Right.
Like, his job is to use it because he was given to it from, it's like, I think it would fall on the person who's responsible for the guns. It's like,
I would agree.
I would.
Except with what happened with Baldwin, the cameras weren't rolling.
Were they rehearsing?
He was like, hey.
If they were rehearsing, that still counts. Like, that still counts as valid practice.
And I haven't looked at this since the incident happened, but from what I understand, it was, he was like, hey, let's act through what we're going to do. Okay, so the cameras aren't rolling. So armor shouldn't have given, like, he shouldn't have access to a gun.
Mm-hmm.
So the armor is liable there as well. He shouldn't have access to the gun because they're rehearsing. He knows better than to point a gun at the co-star, because even when they do the scene, that's not what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then he pulls a trigger. So the armorer is liable, don't get me wrong, but he wasn't doing what the armorer told him to do. The armorer, she was off having lunch already.
A new lunch was involved.
And so what he did, he's responsible for. Yes, she's liable, the armorer, because she wasn't following best practices either, but like, they're both liable, and I believe he was acquitted on all charges, which I think is a mistrial of justice.
It's a messy situation. It's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why you never point a gun at people unless you intend to kill them. Or are prepared to kill them, I should say.
Or it's a nerf.
Even then.
Oh, man.
And you never, ever, ever pick up a gun and don't check to see if it's loaded.
So going back to your main question, like, I don't know if I'd use the word lol.
Right.
But I know, but they could probably be interchangeable. So this is me be just trying to avoid your trigger word of lol. I think there should be regulations on things. Not all things, but if you're on a set and life is involved, humanity, the ability to keep or remove life.
Yeah.
I think there should be some restrictions or boundaries or guidelines.
Okay. Let me ask you a follow-up.
Maybe not specific laws. Whose
responsibility should it be to regulate that?
Oh, a committee, of course. Nelson, you love committees. No, in this situation, when we're talking about film.
Yeah.
So because I don't want to go broader into like United States and government and stuff, but specifically within film, there should probably be a safety advisor. And then that safety advisor should know all the areas where there's going to be safety checks, safety requirements. Obviously, you don't need a safety advisor for a debate, a verbal debate, where the safety advisor, again, there may be a different title for this role, but like safety advisor would be someone who would be over the armorer, who'd be over the cooks, the chefs, the explosives, the pyrotechnics, any time where there's other things outside of human involvement that could have issues. I think there should be someone going over, have we looked at all the safety, have we checked the harnesses on all the stunt cars? Have we just someone just checking, I think someone should be in charge of it. I don't necessarily think that someone needs to be, I don't know. Like, so if there is something to be regulated, that means someone has to regulate it. So that means there is a role. So yeah, like, and for me, that doesn't bother me. Like, to have someone in charge of safety, that sounds great.
Yeah. Most,
it's something, if I was an actor, it's one thing less I would probably have to think about as critical.
Yeah.
I can focus on my lines and then I can make sure I'm worrying about not pointing the gun at someone's head. But in general, everything else, everything beyond that gun part,
right,
I don't have to worry about.
Right.
I have my own guidelines. Yeah. But I don't have to worry about buying the ammo. I don't have to worry about making, I just have to worry about my lines, holding the gun properly, and then moving on. Not shooting
people.
There's someone else that can go, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's best practices, and let's move on. Same with punching. Same with kicking. Yeah. Same with flipping. Same with, going.
All that currently exists.
Right. Here's the best way to backflip. Here's the best way to sweep the leg. Actors can't be expected to be trained in everything.
They
can be versed in it.
Very little of fight choreography is done by actors.
Right. Right.
That's done by stunt doubles.
Unless you're Tom Cruise.
Unless you're Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise.
Very little. Because these are done by stunt doubles who have been trained specifically to do that.
That's right. And a lot of times, guns are the same way. A lot of times, there could even be some gunshots that are done with professional gun handlers.
Yeah.
Versus the actor. Yeah. In the shots. I believe
armorers on set are legally required. I'm not entirely sure. But then there's also safety coordinators. You go to any business, you're going to find somebody whose job is safety coordinator.
Yeah.
And that's almost never a legal thing. It's because that helps with their insurance.
Right.
Right. So I agree with you. It is ideal that you have a safety coordinator on set to make sure that people are being safe.
Yeah.
But also the stunt doubles, they know what's safe. They know what they can do and they know how to do it safely. And they won't, they might push the limits, but anything that's this is very unsafe, they don't want to do because that could be the end of their career. Right. So I agree with you that ideally you would have these safety coordinator positions. I think that in industry regulation on its own is sufficient to manage that. I don't think you need external regulators.
Right.
I
would agree with. You don't need someone that's not on set, that's not on filming location, that's not involved with the movie going, exactly, this is what you should or should not do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. But if they're with anything, whether it's food, parenting, any category of life, if there's a regulation made, there's someone who's made the regulation. So and at that point, you're putting someone involved with regulations. You can't have one without the other. You can't have a regulation, you can't have a boundary, you can't have a guideline created without someone that created it. And so at that point you get someone, whether, unintentionally, is
usually
is creating guidelines. Bureaucrat. Right. So it's unavoidable when you have boundaries.
Yeah.
So of any kind.
I don't think regulation is a bad thing. I think that the government is a terrible vehicle for regulation. I think industry regulation regulates itself best. And there's two things that happen when it's an external regulator. One, the people most familiar with what's being regulated aren't the ones making the decisions. So it's not going to be optimal decisions. But two, you get moral hazard. We've talked about that a little frequently lately.
Moral haggard?
That's right. So moral hazard is an economics thing, but really applies to so many different areas of life. So in economics, moral hazard is if you continue to bail out banks, for example, then banks will know that they don't have to be, they don't have to operate in any specific kind of way that is sensible and safe because they'll be bailed out.
And that reminds us, shout out to our sponsor, Wells Fargo.
And so companies like Wells Fargo will be very reckless in how they manage money
right.
because they know that they'll be bailed out. And we saw that in 2008. That's called moral hazard. Jeff, you and I went to a concert last night.
We did.
And I saw an example of moral hazard there.
Oh.
On the wall behind the bar is a sign that says, Narcan is available.
Yes, I saw that.
And what I
did
saw...
Did you try it?
Yes, can I have some Narcan,
I'll take
please?
Take two shots of Narcan, please.
And what I saw when I... What I thought when I saw that is, this is moral hazard. Not moral as in the sense of heroin's bad, right? I think it's it is bad, but that's not what I mean by this. What I mean is, if I'm a heroin addict and I know Narcan is available, I'm not going to be as cautious as I would if I knew Narcan wasn't available.
Do you really think heroin addicts are thinking about that when they're taking heroin?
Yep.
Really? You think that's something they consider when they've when?
Yep.
Interesting. Okay.
And
I don't know.
Also, a lot of moral hazard is like a subconscious thing. Like, so you might find yourself saying to yourself, well, you know, I can take a little bit more because I know there is Narcan here if I need it. Right? Like, it's not malicious. It's just kind of like a thing, a result of game theory, really. And so, tying back to what we were saying earlier, why did
regulations.
Yeah. Tying back to industry regulations, if a larger party says, hey, all of you people that do business in this area, like a government says, hey, this is the way you have to do this. Well, now the company can really kind of wash its hands of that because all it has to do is meet regulations. So let's say, for example, OSHA sets a regulation and the regulation's a bad one because OSHA often doesn't know what it's talking about. Mm. And the company doesn't have the best interest of its employees in mind. Right, which normally it would because it wants to be as safe as possible to attract employees. But if there's a minimum regulation, they're like, oh, well, we're just going to do that. And then somebody dies, they're actually absolved of responsibility because, hey, we were doing everything OSHA said we should do. That becomes a moral hazard. It disrupts the labor market. It disrupts the incentive structure for safety. Because now, as long as I'm doing what the regulatory board says I have to do, I'm really kind of not to blame. They are. And they need to update their regulations. We saw this a lot in 2020, where people saying, well, I'm just doing what the CDC said. Okay, but the evidence is out there that what the CDC said is wrong. And you're washing your hands of any kind of responsibility by just like putting that decision-making to somebody else. You know?
Mm-hmm. So more laws. Definitely need more laws in place.
Yeah, it's probably a problem that we could fix with more laws and more regulation. Yeah,
we should.
If only we could just elect the right guy.
We should do a committee.
Yeah.
Nelson and I are going to start a committee. No, that makes sense to me. What you said, not what I said. Just to clarify. But in the same sense, though, like, putting that sign up, do you think, like, it's an innocent act, right? Like, it's like their intentions is probably like an act of like help, right? Like, or do you specifically with the concert and that the Narcan sign, like, do you think they did that because they're required and it makes them feel better? Or do you think they did that because like they truly care and maybe they've had issues in the past of overdoses on site and like now they're like for me, like, I want to know the intentions behind it. Like, I can trust a guy that runs a music venue way more than I can trust a government guy. Like, so like, it's like, what was his, what's his or her intention about putting a sign up? Like, is it because they've had issues in the past and now they're like, I want people to know that they're safe here?
I think that, that kind of nanny state regulate at the regulatory level, it comes from a position of, we want what's best for the people that live here, and we think this will do it. Just like how people that take advantage, like just how moral hazard corrupts people in, at a subconscious level, it's not like a malicious thing. The regulation or the behavior that creates the moral hazard also usually comes with a, we think that this is what's best. So for that music venue, it could be that they've had issues in the past. It could be that people that work there have close family and friends who have had that issue, not at that location.
Right.
I believe that the reason they have that Narcan is available sign is legitimately because this is something that is a sensitive issue for them. And they want people to know that, hey, if something happens in this specific way, we got you covered. I think that they do it for the right reason. I don't think most people know what moral hazard is or how it affects people.
Yeah.
Right? So
I couldn't even tell you one of his songs.
So, you know, if I was that owner, I think the instinct to have Narcan on hand at a venue like that, I think it makes sense.
But to advertise it is your issue.
But to advertise it actually increases the chance that you'll need to use it.
Maybe this is the wrong episode to talk about this, but this hasn't come up yet. So first and foremost, I'm about this humanity. Like if people are breathing, like people just like live. Like I never want to be in the position where I'm going, where I have to choose between life or death for someone.
Okay. Okay.
And I know when this whole Narcan thing out, cause like here in the state of Ohio, I can't speak for other states, but just it's relevant just cause like I remember hearing it a lot back in the, like during 2020 and even a little bit before, we had a pretty big overdose
epidemic.
I don't know if that's the right.
We have an opioid and heroin epidemic that's real bad in Ohio. It's
still going, but it was a lot of our conversation earlier a couple years ago. Everyone was talking about. It's like so Narcan came up a lot, and then with that came the conversation of like, well, if we just keep pumping them, like, and just this is just a generic if, like not specifically like me, but like how many times should we Narcan someone before we go? No, like, and just like, and so that conversation has come up before, like, and this is a hot topic for some people because some people don't like Narcan.
I know people,
like, and they're just like, no, if they're going to choose to do that, like,
that's
let the medical professionals focus on other people. Like, but for me, it's just like, if there's a life to save, I don't think there's any time where you go, no, not this time. Like, but just, yeah. So just when I think of Narcan, I always think of that debate of like, how many times do you revive someone before you go, if you overdose for a third time, we're not doing this. Like, but like for me, it's just like,
so I agree with you.
Yeah.
I know people that say we shouldn't even have Narcan in police vehicles. And that if someone's going to overdose, that's on them.
Right.
And I'm sympathetic to that line of thinking. I'm also very sympathetic to the line of thinking of if you have the opportunity to intervene so that somebody doesn't die, even if it's attempted suicide, you intervene.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a case by case basis. So let's say that I have a close friend who, you know, is constantly overdosing and I Narcan them like 10 times. And after a while I'm like, all right, buddy, I'm done. I'm out. If you do this again, I won't be there to save you. I think that makes sense. Yeah. I think it makes sense even for a police precinct to decide that for an individual. And communicate that, or a hospital say, hey, we've done this a bunch of times, we're done. I think that's fine. What I think would be very, very bad is if a police officer were hamstrung by a law that said, we know on file this man's already been Narcan 5 times, and so we are not allowed to intervene. I think that would be tragic.
Yeah.
Because now you put a person in a position where he's not allowed to act on his own morality.
Right.
Because even like, let's say the precinct says, hey, we're not going to do it anymore, officer rolls up to the thing, he's like, you know, I'm still going to do it, I'm still going to take another chance.
Right. Now the officer's in trouble.
Well, it's the officer's, right? It's the precinct doesn't have his back, it's the officer thing. But if there's a law that says he can't, like that's tragic,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I struggle with that because, like, you know, in my opinion, and the way I believe God can work, and in the way I believe, like, I've seen God work in some instances, like,
yeah.
If there's still breath in our lungs, even if we're unconscious, like,
yeah.
We have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Like God can still use us and stuff. And like, so for me, it's just like, whether it's the first time or like the 21st time, like,
feels like the first time. Feels like the 21st
time. Is that
time.
Merle Haggard?
No.
Oh, I get the logic about going like, okay, I can't keep worrying about you. I can't keep calling and checking on you. Yep. Like, granted, I don't have anyone close to me. Like, I've never really dealt with this firsthand, which I guess I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
But in the same sense, being that Ohio has had it a lot and stuff, like I probably know someone who has dealt with it, who has dealt with someone who's dealt with it. Like,
I definitely do.
Like, it just, and I've said this before in on episodes, like, I don't want to play God.
Right.
And so if someone is living, I'd like to keep someone living.
Well, that's playing God.
No, I'm saying like I also don't want to have the decision of I'm not going to revive you. Because then, like, I would rather play, if so I have to, like, I'd rather play in the favor of life-giving versus life-removing.
If you knew somebody was DNR, do not resuscitate, would you resuscitate?
Ooh. Like, whether natural causes or drugs, just in general, DNR? Yeah. Hospital or not, like outside of a hospital?
Outside of a hospital.
And I knew they were a DNR?
Yeah. I don't think you could be held liable for DNR because
right. You're
not a medical professional.
It also depends. If it was a 90-year-old man.
Yeah,
who's
definitely.
Who's going.
He's still got a full life ahead of
just
him.
Just let me go. Like, just let me go. Don't, like, I have a DNR. Like, yeah. He communicated, I have a DNR. And yeah. And he also, like, he was also telling me, I don't know why it's a guy in my mind. He's also going, just let me go. Let me be. I think that situation will be a lot easier of going, okay. Then I don't know if you can have a DNR and be 30 or 20.
You
like,
can.
But say it's a 20-year-old and they crashed and they go, just let me go. I'm in too much pain. I would probably be a lot more akin to help the 20-year-old. Be like, no, I'm saving you.
Yeah.
But if it's a 90-year-old or a 100-year-old person going, don't do it, I'd be like, all right, cool. Like,
yeah.
Do you want me to help you? Like, do you want me to grab a pillow and make it quicker? Like, sorry, that's dumb. Like, I wouldn't do that. But like in some cases, what's the one clause? Assisted death. Like, it makes sense in my head.
Yeah,
I don't know how I feel about it. And I guess in going back to the DNR question, like, I don't know. I don't know what I would do. Because I imagine even if it's a 90-year-old person, my brain's still going, he's got a soul. He's got a life. He's got a heart. Like, do something.
Yeah.
Like, I am, if I'm trained, if I have the skills to do whatever is required.
Right.
Like, I have a feeling I would do something no matter what the cause.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel like that's what I would do in the moment. But sitting here on a couch, like, I don't know. It's like, if someone's terminally ill and the doctors have gone, we can't save you, you're going to need a miracle. I believe in miracles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do. I believe in miracles. So, like, for me, it's like, okay,
since
then I think if you still have breath
thing,
in your lungs,
you sexy thing. You.
Yeah. If you still have breath in your lungs, then I still believe God can do a miracle.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't want to prevent the ability for God to work. And if it's a DNR, if it's a 115-year-old person going, just put me out. I want to be with my wife who went 70 years ago.
Right.
Like, even at that, I'm like, I can't, bro. Like, I can't do it. Like, I don't think I'd be able to do it.
Yeah.
I would want them to fight to live, and I would
fight for them to live.
Yeah. And again, it comes down to the situation. Like, I don't want to play God. Like, they're living for a reason. That's not because of me. That's because of God.
And also, like, if it's their time. Nothing that I'm going to do is going to prevent them. So
right.
I might as well fight for it.
Right.
Now this was back from Moral Hazard, which was back from not Renee Falconetti, but a stunt double having themselves
cutting their
punctured.
Arm. Yeah, real
that's,
blood.
That's wild. So now we're back to Joan of Arc.
Back to Joan of Arc.
Do you have anything else?
Not specifically with that. No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, me either. I thought that this movie was.
Oh, Wait, for the whole movie?
No.
Oh, okay. I was like, I've got stuff for the rest of the movie, but yeah, for that specific... Okay, I got you.
So, when she's being sworn in, the Bible was chained up. I looked it up. This movie is praised for historical accuracy, even in costume design.
Mm-hmm.
The guards looked like World War I soldiers. And because it was just after World War I, I was like, that's probably what it was. Apparently, no, that is what the guards in the 1400s would have dressed like.
Really?
But the Bible chained up, that was pure artistic expression. And it's a representation of how this court was chained by its theology.
Mm.
But also, because the Bible's chained up, they're not looking at actually what's in the document.
Right.
You can't open the Bible to read it.
It's the idea of the Bible, not the actual context exactly. in Scripture.
Exactly.
Huh, that's interesting. My mind immediately went to Mulan. When the movie Mulan, like where like you've got a female doing military stuff and ends up leading a military.
And Mulan's also based off a real person.
Is it really?
Inspired okay. by one.
That
yeah.
I didn't know.
Let me double check that.
Obviously, I hope we're in a place where the idea of a female leading in different aspects isn't a taboo anymore. But like.
Scholars generally consider Mulan to be a fictional character. But she's a legendary folk. Hua Mulan is a legendary folk heroine depicted in Wu Shuangpu's, which is the Table of Peerless Heroes by Jin Guliang.
Okay.
So generally considered to be a fictional character, but it's entirely possible that she is circa 18th century.
Yeah.
No, that's not right.
18th century, that's very close to modern.
No. The piece of art that I was looking at was 18th century.
Gotcha.
The Ballad of Mulan, the first appearance of it, is 6th century.
Okay. 500s.
Yeah. And that long ago, it's entirely possible, like, yes, this was a real person that really lived.
And I imagine this isn't, like, between Joan of Arc and the idea of Mulan, like,
yeah.
This isn't a, those aren't the only two times, like, there was a need that was needed.
Yeah.
And a lady goes, I can do this.
Yeah.
And like,
well, it's the story of
Babe Pig in the City.
There's a female Old Testament.
Ruth?
No. It's Judges. I think Deborah.
Oh, Debbie. Little Debbie. Yeah. And that's where we get our treats today based on the biblical
character.
Okay,
so here's the story. Book of Judges, Deborah. The fourth judge of pre-monarchic Israel and the only female judge.
Okay. That was okay. Keep going.
And people of Israel are being oppressed by Jabin, king of Canaan. And basically, none of the men were stepping up. And so God's like, all right, I'm going to shame you all by having a woman do it.
Yeah.
And this biblical narrative of Deborah is something that we do see repeated through history. We see, you know, we see it with Mulan, which may or may not have been a real character. We see it with Joan of Arc, and we see it with there's this Russian woman, she was a sniper,
Vladimir,
and she had a pet bear.
Wait, a Russian, she was a sniper?
Yeah,
that's awesome. She had a pet bear.
Lyudmila Pavlichenko, 1943, Ukrainian.
Okay,
sorry. She was a Soviet sniper in the Red Army during World War II. She's credited with 309 kills.
Ooh, I do not want that on me.
She served in the Red Army during the siege of Odessa, the siege of Sevastopol, and the early fighting of the Eastern Front. Her score of 309 kills places her in the top five snipers of all time. Her kills are likely much more numerous, as a confirmed kill has to be witnessed by a third party. 309 confirmed kills. This means 309 times somebody else saw. Yeah, you definitely got them.
But from what I know of snipers, like a lot of times they work individually. Like, so they're by themselves in some situations.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's incredible. At the same time, it's very morbid.
There's nothing in the Wikipedia page about a bear. So I don't know where I got the thing about her having a bear.
There are bears in the Ukraine, though. So it's possible. But going back to like, obviously, like, 21st century, 2023, 2024, there's been an upswing in the idea of feminists, whether it's on the healthy side or even like the radical side.
Yeah.
Back then, there was a lot more taboo on, you know, even like, you know, you see it in Mary Poppins back in that, whatever time that movie took place, you know, women couldn't vote. Well, like votes for women, like just things like that. Like this idea of like women being steps behind men. Like, I think the, one of the broader topics in this movie was just this idea of like a woman stepping up, a man hadn't done it yet. A group of men, whatever. No one had done it before.
Well,
even a previous woman hadn't done it before.
Basically, like, one of the biggest influences she had was, like, the first thing she did was inspire King Charles to fight back. Right? King Charles wasn't fighting back. He wasn't protecting his people.
Right.
So she stepped up when others wouldn't to say, hey, this is what you got to be doing.
Yeah.
Now, some cynics who don't think, or skeptics who don't think she was inspired by God, think that what she told him was something to the effect of, no, you aren't a bastard, and you are legitimate, and you need to free the people. And it wouldn't necessarily have been something that only God could know. Anybody could know that this is what he needed to hear.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Do you, and I'm trying to get into this topic without being like,
go right for it.
Because like you and I are, for the use that don't know, we're guys, for the listeners that are not aware of that. Do you think there are positions in any category of employment, leadership, even outside of what we believe scripturally, that couldn't be female led, or maybe that has not had a female leader at, or a female at the head of it? Like, are there places where there's still taboo of like, oh, a woman doing that, that's outrageous, that's preposterous? Like is there anything that this could translate to 2024 where if we saw something like this where a woman's doing something that we're like, what is she doing there? I'm thinking of like the president. We haven't had a woman president yet. Right now we've got a woman vice president, which I haven't heard her name said since the election. Like, is she even doing anything? Sorry, that's more political, not gender focused. But just like, are there any roles where like a woman hasn't? I don't know what I'm asking. I just feel like it's. I still feel at times it's still taboo. A woman doing something, just in general, and guys going, she can't do that. Well, she can't do like. Is there still areas?
There's only one taboo I know of for that.
What's that?
Which would be female pastors.
Okay. And so
I don't know of anybody
outside of female pastors.
I don't know of any serious person that gets upset when women are in positions of authority.
Okay.
I know people that would not work in a place where their direct boss was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. But I know people that's something that they feel is outside of what scripture allows for roles of leadership. I don't see that. Personally, what I do see is that Paul, when talking about pastors and elders, talks about how they also need to be husbands of one wife, and how they have to father their children well. He only ever speaks of it as a role that men fill. That doesn't mean that women don't have a role in the church, right? Because we see a lot of women running feeding programs, women organizing different and roles like being treasurers and different things like that within,
and teaching like not pastoring but just teaching, women teaching, like, she's,
give me an example.
Like, I think, oh, and I'm also not well versed on this either, to like, so I don't want to get super into the debate because I don't know much about, like, but teaching a congregation is different than leading a church for a season of life. Like, just
okay.
Having a lady teach, so for one sermon.
You're making a distinction between
delivering a sermon versus leading the church entirely, doing everything a pastor does day in and day out, versus, oh, we have a special speaker today who she's teaching. Like I think there is a difference between leading a church, pastoring a flock, versus teaching once every now and then. And it not being her role as a career or as a, like, I think there, like, I see that differently. And I think it is important, especially, like, I think it's important for us to hear from all different perspectives.
Okay. So what do you then do with woman, 1 Timothy 2:12?
You read it. It's a scripture?
Yeah, okay.
So, just with, like, any other verse.
Here it is in the King James Version, which is the only version that you and I read, of course.
Yeah.
But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence.
I don't know how to interpret that, but my kickback question to that would be then, what about a Christian single mom? So, because to teach, you don't need to be at a pulpit. So like you can teach your children, you can teach your nieces and nephews, you can teach someone. So like, so what about a single mom who's teaching a group of students in her home about Jesus? Is that wrong?
So, well,
does she have to go, I can't teach you about the Bible. We need a guy in here.
Yeah. Well, shall we read the entire chapter? It's quite short. Cause then we can have, we'll have it within its context.
Yeah. I don't have a watch, so I don't know what time. We're good.
So this is Instructions for Worship, chapter 2, verses 8 on. Therefore, I want the men everywhere to pray, lifting up holy hands without anger or disputing. I also want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves not with elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds, appropriate for women who profess to worship God. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man, sometimes translated over her husband. She must be quiet, for Adam was formed first than Eve, and Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. And there's a lot of discussion over saved through childbearing, what that means. But mostly focusing on what he says there in 12, I think this is in the context of instructions on worship. So I think this is like in a service gathering type situation.
There's a lot in there that I've got opinions about, but yeah. I don't necessarily know if I have the facts to back it up. Like, so girls can't wear, so, okay. So that's talking just specifically in a worship setting.
I believe so.
Okay. So, can't wear earrings, can't wear adorn yourself in like fine jewels in a worship setting.
Yeah, you should dress modestly.
So you can do it outside of church. So you're making a
I understand this as being a
within a worship setting.
And I might be wrong in that. There might be people that look at this and like, no, this is what we should be doing all the time.
But if I'm not wrong, church settings back in Paul's time were home churches.
Yep.
So it would still be a group of 10, 15, maybe 20.
Yeah,
gathered in a home.
Yeah. Or in a synagogue on Sunday.
Correct. Like, so like, it's like, I don't know. Because, like, we've had her on twice, Sarah.
Yeah.
Lovely. She's preached before at our church. Yeah, we go to church with her.
She's great at it.
She's wonderful. She's well educated and she's got a great perspective on things. And, like, I would love to know what she thinks about this verse because like I don't know how to answer.
You know who's going
to
be a great person to ask about this?
Jesus.
Carrie Baldwin.
Oh man, we should have her on.
Yeah, maybe next week.
It sounds great.
Is it next week?
Yep.
Okay.
12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men. Okay, well, continuing back to the conversation. So I don't have strong feelings on this.
Okay.
I wouldn't leave a church because it has a female giving a sermon, right? As we've said, Sarah has delivered sermons at our church. I have not left over it. And so I don't even know how to navigate this because I don't have strong feelings on it. But I do know plain text, like this is what it says.
Correct. Yeah, it's...
And I haven't wrestled with that, really. I have friends that have wrestled with it and they've committed to, I can't go to a church that does this because I feel, based on what I read, that this is incorrect.
Maybe the worship setting is different than leading family members or like personal relationship friends and stuff like just, but like for me, teaching is teaching.
Yeah.
And if you're teaching the scripture, if you're teaching the Bible, whether it's to your family or to a group of people in a home church,
yeah,
there's no different. If I'm teaching my children, I'm going to be teaching them the same things that I would teach to a small congregation, a small home church people. Like,
right.
And like,
I think it's very me, hard. Like, I think it would be very, very difficult though to argue that Paul would scold a mother for teaching her children about
and Jesus. It just where's the line then? Like,
and that's why I think this is a service context,
right? And it's just
a gathering context,
right? And it's just an interesting like because like I think there's value in listening to other people because women experience speaking from a man, like women experience life differently. They see things different because life for women is different than it is men. We react differently.
Yeah. That's true.
And I think to hear the perspective on things like that is valuable. I grew up in a house with four sisters and a mom, and like it's like, and no brothers. Like, I grew up in a very female dominant house, and I'm grateful for it. My mom was more of the spiritual leader in my house than my father mm-hmm. was. And for me, I don't have an issue with that. Like, I don't think my faith suffered from it. My mom did a lot of teaching. And so, like, I don't see how there can be negative outcomes from it. Again, and I'm not talking, my mom didn't pastor a church, but my mom did teach Sunday school. Yeah. My mom did, like, and Sunday, yes. So Sunday school teachers, do they all have to be males?
I think.
Like a third grade Sunday school class that has to be a male teacher?
Let me say this.
Like,
I think, if we were to take a plain text reading.
Yes.
And we're talking, this is in a gathering context, right?
Yes.
So not like this is apart from, you know, how it's handled in the home, but even in the home, there's something to be said here where it says it shouldn't be teaching and usurp the authority of a man, sometimes translated her husband. I think it could be argued here that what Paul's communicating is that the proper role of men in families is to be filling that teaching role and that spiritual head. And I think that, you know, when we go back to Genesis where it says, and your desire shall be for him. That was what a lot of people understand this as a carnal desire. No. It's a desire for his role in as lead of the family. When men don't step up, women do.
Yeah.
And oftentimes too, when women step up, men are like, ah, well, it's not my problem anymore, right? So yeah. I think a lot of that usurped leadership is not a malicious thing. I think a lot of that's kind of like just result of...
It's a natural outcome.
It's a natural outcome of sinful desires.
Yeah.
And that when men lead properly, women are... this is just going to sound male chauvinist, and that's unfortunately the way it's going to have to sound. When men step up and lead, I think a lot of women are happy to be led. Not that they're some kind of sheep, because most men are happy to be led as well.
Yeah.
I think that oftentimes when women take these roles,
those women,
I love women. Women. Are you familiar with that?
No.
It's this this black guy at a church service. And he's like, I'm not gay anymore. I like women.
Yeah.
Women.
Yeah.
So I think oftentimes that when women see that these roles are not being filled, that they step up and fill them. And I think that's a natural thing. And I think a lot of men who are called to fill these positions don't. And so then when women do step up, they're like, well, now I don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's kind of the what's happening there. I don't feel so strongly about it that when I see a woman in a position of authority that like I get really upset about it. I don't feel strongly about this. But I do look for areas in my life where I haven't stepped up to the plate and need to.
Yeah. I
think too often in the conversation about that kind of complementarian view of men and women, I think we spend too much of it looking at women. And I can't make those decisions for them.
Right.
I need to make how does this apply to me? What am I supposed to be doing as a result of this? And what I see there is, I would disagree with Paul slightly where he says that it wasn't Adam that was deceived, it was the woman. Well, I disagree with Paul slightly in that Adam was there and he didn't step up.
Right.
Right. And so there was a failure of Adam as well there. And he did eat the apple, right. even though.
Yeah, Adam is not without fault.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't think Paul would disagree with that. I think Paul would agree. But he was just saying that she was deceived first.
What would have been different is if Adam went, no, I don't want to take a bite.
Yeah.
That would have completely changed Adam going like, no, what did you do? Right. I don't want that. But he immediately like, okay, yeah, let me have a taste. Like,
And it says Adam who was there with her, meaning like the whole time this conversation is happening.
They were together.
And he's not intervening. So it was a failure of leadership on his part.
I agree.
And a failure to intervene on his part.
And they didn't have belly buttons. So just wanted to make sure that was stated. Can't prove that. I can.
So that's where I like come down on this is what is a proper role of women in church? Well, from what I see in scripture, it seems to say this. I understand why that makes people uncomfortable. And I think that it's far more important that men be looking at and answering the question of what is the proper role of men in church? And I think oftentimes that as much as we're failing to meet the what Paul outlines for the proper role of women in church, we're also failing to meet the proper role of men in church.
And I do like, and I think there's other factors that go into this outside of specific leadership roles, because like the church has changed too. So like, it's like, this is what I'm saying. Like the Americanization of church. So like, so what the building of a church requires now in 2024 versus what a church required back in biblical times. Like, no, there was no paid staff at a church.
No, but Paul argued that they should.
Right. But so just like now, if we're an establishment, if we're a functional facility now,
right,
now we have leadership roles that need fulfilled and stuff like, it's like, so as the church evolved and got more westernized,
right,
like they got more structured and more regulated, even in
best practices and that kind of stuff.
Different denominations. There it is.
Yeah.
They get like you get regulations from denominations. And so like, so as these things happen, positions are created that need to be filled. And from that, it becomes less about leading people and more about building something.
Yeah.
Which is so like, it's like, and again, a big church, a big healthy church is not, that's not my issue, but just like, as what the church looks like now in modern times, I think it requires different things than what the church, the original church was requires. I've talked about this book before. It was a Francis Chan book, Letters to the, hold on, let me bring it up. I want to say the title correctly. And it really changed the way I think about churches. Like, I'm not anti big church. We go to a pretty big sized church comparatively.
Yep.
We don't go to a mega church, and I'm not a huge fan of mega churches. We have three campuses total and stuff. It's like we do have a bigger congregation when you go to everyone that's involved. Let me bring up this book title here real quick.
Yeah, and actually it's pretty relevant because part of what she was being tried for was the heresy of being a woman in leadership, right?
Right. So, Letters to the Church by Francis Chan.
Okay.
Link below. Yeah, he talks about how like he's going more to a home church model.
Yeah.
And how he's like he's designed the system to where the teachers work a full-time job still. They're still involved in the community. They're 100% of the money that is tithed to that home church, 100% of it goes into the community. None of it goes to staffing. Mm-hmm. And so like, there's no childcare. There's no facilities operator. There's no parking lot run. Like none of that stuff is needed. It's like, and he gives scripture. It was early on in 2023 when I read it. It's not coming back to me fresh.
Right.
But just this idea of like modern church requires different things than what I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, what I believe was desired for the original church.
I think that's correct.
And because of that, roles were created and we go, well, if a guy's not going to step up, the role needs filled.
Yeah.
That's where there's gray areas. I think there is some issue with the modern church as far as like how it's structured or the size of what we achieve.
We're saying that with the deepest of compassion to all of our friends,
correct,
who are pastors and who are staff members at churches.
And I don't think it negates impact, because with big churches comes big budgets and big reach.
Yeah.
So there is still big impact and God still works. So I'm not arguing bigger. I'm not arguing any church outside of a house church is wrong.
No.
I'm just saying, I don't think it's the truest biblical structure of what a church should be.
Do you think that makes sense? We as Christians have a responsibility to do church as closely as intended.
I'm going to be honest. After reading that book, I was really challenged about it. And honestly, I do think it really did.
Then I don't think it's wrong to say, I do think that the way we do church is wrong.
I think. I guess why it's hard is because I'm a part of it. Like it's convicting.
No, I understand. I
hate acknowledging conviction.
Yeah. Well, oh man, ain't that the truth?
So yeah, so
I don't have a whole lot left for this movie.
Okay.
I think one of the biggest things to wrestle with that I touched on it earlier, you know, is just this corruption of church when involved with the state. It all these perverse incentive structures. The really interesting way that it repeated itself with the film. Right?
Yeah.
With the Catholic censorship and the French government censorship. And then I think the biggest thing to take from Joan of Arc is like, it's again, it's the Hua Mulan, it's the Lady Sniper, it's the, it's Deborah.
Lady Bear Sniper.
It's Deborah. And then Little it's Debbie. What I think we kind of settled on for proper role of women and men in church. It's like, these are roles of leadership that God intended for men.
Yeah.
And when no man will step up, he will find a woman to step up.
Yeah.
And an impact is made, and it's going to be a huge impact to show, like, to frustrate the misogyny of women shouldn't be doing that, but also to like kind of fly in the face of, well, if men would step up and do it, she wouldn't have to be doing that.
Yeah,
you know, especially when it comes to war, I do thoroughly believe that women shouldn't be going to war.
Okay.
Even
what about the medical front? What about women working at like war front hospitals?
That's a little bit different because they're not targets. I think that, and the reason
front lines, you would prefer women not to be on the front lines.
And it's not because I don't think women can do it. It's because I value the life of a woman so much more than a man that I want them in safe situations.
It's a lot more tragic when a woman's life is lost than a man's.
I think so.
I'd agree with that. I get that.
And so that's, and historically that's the reason why women don't go to war as well.
Yeah.
We value the life of women so much more. I know that a lot of women scoff at that notion that, that female life is more valuable than male life. And not just scoff at it because they're egalitarians, but they'll scoff at it in the sense of like, women don't have the same rights as men. And that's a conversation for a different episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's get into wrap up, shall we?
Yes.
We're going to change things up a bit, Jeff. Yeah.
We're going to gender swap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'll be the man.
Yeah.
Would you change the content rating? It is passed.
No.
What modern, like if you were to give it a content rating today, what would you give it?
Okay. So there's two scenes that are in question. One is the blood, the poking of the skin and blood squirting.
Yep.
It's graphic.
Yeah.
And it's not quick. Like it's on the screen for a little bit.
Yeah.
The other scene is there is no nipple shown, but there is a shot of breastfeeding.
No, that nipple was very much shown.
Did you? Okay. I missed the nipple. It's not a long scene.
Yeah.
But there is a shot of breastfeeding.
A suckling babe who then turns away and looks at Joan of Arc.
It's close to the end where Joan, and I think Joan's, she's contemplating her, like, she's seeing her life.
Yeah.
She's having these visions of, like, I don't know if she didn't have a baby, so I don't know if she's remembering being a baby.
It's not sexy boob.
It's no.
It's just like, here's a breastfeeding.
But there is nudity.
And no face attached to the woman either.
There is quick, but frontal nudity.
Yeah.
Chest nudity.
A singular boob.
And then there is graphic blood.
Yeah.
So with those two scenes, PG-13.
I'd give this PG.
Even with both of those.
Okay. Because the context of both of those.
Okay.
I think that the breastfeeding.
A boob is a boob though. Like if you're a pubescent boy, like a boob is a boob. Like, and that, I guess that's my only reason of going PG-13.
You might be right.
Ooh, there's a boob in this movie. Like, I remember being a punk boy going, haha, booby. Like that's my only reason. Like, if you can be mature about it, then yes, it is not a sexualized boob. It is not, nothing in this movie is sexual.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is a breast in the film. And if someone under 13, a boy under 13, he's going to go, ooh, a boob, not a, oh, that woman is breastfeeding her child. Like, it's going to be hard for a boy to be mature about it.
I agree. But also, like,
and that's what ratings are for.
Living in Guatemala, women breastfed in the public, without coverings or anything.
It is an American thing.
And so, Americans specifically are kind of weird about it. I'd like my boys to be, like, comfortable with breastfeeding. I do think it's still modest and appropriate for women to wear a covering, but, like, babies breastfeed, and you need to be okay with that.
In a culture, like, if we were in a culture that was a lot less like, oh my goodness, she's breastfeeding, then I think it would be like I also am, I've never breastfed Nelson, but I've never breastfed you specifically is what I'm saying.
But in general,
in a culture where it's like, it's more just like, okay, she's feeding. Okay, cool. It's not sexualized. It's not shocking.
Yeah.
And yeah, but like, but because America has like, oh, it's boobs.
A taboo on breastfeeding.
Unfortunately, I do think it is I don't care if it's out in the public.
Yeah.
But if a breast is exposed, I do think that it's almost like open carrying. like oh, he's got a gun and he's not concealing it.
Right.
Oh, she's got a breast. She's not concealing it. It's there's shock value to
open it. Open carry and boobs.
There's shock value to it that I don't think's needed.
Okay.
But unfortunately, it happens.
And I don't think it was intended to be shocking though.
No, not in that movie. No. Yeah, it was. Yeah, there was nothing in that movie that felt like, oh, this was just cash. This was for the boys.
Yeah.
Like, no, it was not like that.
Yeah, so I wouldn't give it G. Like, I wouldn't say, no. But I think that this is an appropriate movie.
And the topic, I mean, you see an execution. Well, an implied execution. Yeah. So there's dark themes, too.
Yeah.
So definitely not G. Definitely not. I have a hard time with PG.
I'd still give it PG.
Okay.
Would you recommend it?
No. No. There's nothing in this movie that you can't get from other stuff. Like, I would recommend Mulan over this movie.
Yeah.
For female empowerment. The idea that it took a woman to step in a man's place, you can get any of these things from a different, as far as like facial expressions and good acting, there's other movies that have equivalent, if not better, physical acting in dramatic roles from females.
Mm-hmm.
Like none of the male actors were standout. Like where I'm just talking specifically, like Maria Falconetti was the only actress or actor in this movie that stood out.
Yep.
And so you can get that from other movies. So there's nothing in this movie where I'm going, you need to watch this.
I would recommend it because I think it will, like it has for me, make people more curious about Joan of Arc.
There's other Joan of Arc movies.
But I think, I don't think I've seen any of them.
I haven't either, but like.
And I think that this is probably the most critically acclaimed one.
Yeah, that is true. That is a fact.
And so, like, if I'm going to recommend a Joan of Arc thing to wet your palate and make you want more curious, I think this is the best way to do it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Do you think it holds up or has aged well? I would say probably not.
No. Yeah. No,
For all the reasons you just said about why you wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah. I don't think it has. Like, this is a movie that I think you can tell the exact same story. You can hold the historical accuracy. You can give the same emotion. You can do it. You can modernize it and not lose anything.
Yeah.
And it has been, I think the only reason that those things haven't been those other Joan of Arc movies haven't been life changing is because this one was so on the forefront at the time.
Yeah.
I think it is kind of taboo to go, oh, we've trumped this movie now. Mm-hmm. Like, or as people say now, we've Donald this movie now. Like,
do people say that?
No, that'd be fun though. I think the only reason why none of these movies or new interpretations of Joan of Arc have come out because this one was so iconic.
Yeah,
they don't want to stomp on that.
Right.
But I don't think it would be hard. And maybe they are. Again, I haven't seen the other ones. Maybe there is another one that's a little less well known that does a better job at telling this.
Yeah.
But like, I could see this one being redone. And not missing anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and I hate being a hater, but yeah, this was,
I agree. Now I think I know the answer to this. Would it be in your top 50?
Oh, absolutely. Probably top three.
Top 250.
No, it falls very short.
I would agree. Yeah. Why do you think it is in the top 250, Jeff?
Maria Falconetti. It's not the soundtrack because even various versions have different songs. Like it's not the musical accompaniment because various versions use different accompaniments. I think between her and no one in this movie intentionally wore makeup because they wanted all the faces to feel vulnerable and just
to, oh, actually, sorry, to reword that a little bit differently. The director did not allow makeup.
Correct. For the intention of wanting there to be nothing between the audience and the actors and actresses for authenticity. Like,
and they use specific lighting to get a more grim and grotesque palette in the black and white.
So some of the camera angles are pretty iconic. There are some cool, and I say cool, like in like, oh wow, that's a cool shot. Like there's some cool shots cinematically.
Yeah.
But I think her facial expressions, the way she evoked emotion.
Yeah.
Is good. Was well done. I think that's why it's still on. And the fact that it was the first of its kind to do some of the things they did in this film, that's what keeps it iconic.
Yeah, I agree. And did it title drop?
It didn't drop anything.
No.
Like, if we're going for audibly saying the name, nothing was audibly said in this movie.
Well, I think we gave Metropolis a pass because it does say Metropolis in the title cards.
The name Joan of Arc is said. I don't know. I don't know if the word The Passion is.
No, I didn't see it. I didn't notice it if it was.
Did you? So I watched neither subbed nor dubbed. So just being like the version that we should my TV for some reason wouldn't put on the subs.
Yeah.
And obviously it was not dubbed because there is no dialogue. So like, it's like my subs didn't work. I couldn't read any of the dialogue. Oh. None of the transcripts came up in what I watched.
Oh, right, because the titles cards are not in English.
Correct.
They're not in French either.
No.
They're in Danish.
So it didn't translate on my screen.
Oh, so you had
nothing. I didn't get no dialogue. Oh, okay. I did look up quotes. Like, I did look up a transcript later after watching it. I read through conversations.
Yeah.
Again, being translated, so like, I don't know if they missed something, but like, when I watched the film, I was literally just going on emotion and I received the story. I followed along.
Yeah.
I missed things, obviously.
Right.
Because I wasn't getting specific details, but I was able to follow along. And I think that was cool. I appreciated that.
That's an impressive level of acting though. If you had no context, it's except great. For what you're seeing. Yeah.
Well done. What did help was going after watching it, going through and reading some of those title cards.
Yeah.
I went back and read the title cards.
Okay. All right. And last question to wrap up here. In what ways is this similar to A Clockwork Orange?
There's a boob.
There is a boob.
Yeah. And there's blood.
And blood.
Real
boob, fake blood. Real
boob, fake blood.
In Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
Real boob, real blood.
Yeah. So this movie's better than A Clockwork Orange.
If those are your, if that's
we're rating every movie on real blood, real boob. this movie meets both of those and wins. I'm assuming there's no crossover with casting or anything. Like, they're
not a one.
There can't be.
Well, there could be.
There can't be.
Oh, okay.
There can't.
It's only 40 years.
The great grandson of how many years?
40.
Okay, so yeah, I guess one generation away.
Possible. Young man playing.
No, I mean, just being put on the spot to answer that question, those would be my two answers. There's boobs and blood. Yeah, I mean, Clockwork Orange is definitely not about female empowerment.
No.
There is a little bit of there's not an actual trial in Clockwork Orange, but there is where the character does stand in front of someone and gets, when he goes to the jail type setting. I'm trying to remember Clockwork Orange. It's been over a year. When he gets he goes to a jail type setting, right?
Yep.
Yeah. There is that setting of where he's going, like, they like you, you're here because of this. Like, yeah. There is that, like, you wronged.
Right.
But I mean, that's a minimal. But that's all I got. What about, do you have anything else that you would compare?
No, not a thing.
Okay. Right. Next week,
12 Angry Men with Carey Baldwin. Linked below is where you can find more content from Carey Baldwin. She's terrific. Mm. I think you're going to be really impressed with her.
No relation to Alec.
We don't know that.
Actually, we don't.
We'll ask her.
Okay.
And 12 Angry Men, which was her pick.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see.
Have you seen this movie yet?
I don't think I have.
Do you know anything about it?
I think it's a courtroom drama.
Yes. So I also believe it's that in one of the videos I watched for this movie, for Joan of Arc, 12 Angry Men came up.
Oh, really?
And so just sharing this now, because
love to, and
maybe they were wrong. We'll find out next week if they were wrong, but they stated that 12 Angry Men, the whole movie takes place in one room. We never leave the room.
Interesting. And we do in the Passion of Joan of Arc, but not by much.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm intrigued.
We didn't plan two back-to-back horror dramas.
No.
In fact, Passion of Joan of Arc was chosen at random for us by our list. And then 12 Angry Men was chosen for us by Carrie Baldwin herself, which we will have next week.
Yeah.
Links below where you can watch that, and links below where you can find more from her to get familiar with her before she comes on. Yeah.
And without giving too any more details, like, you and I schedule out our episodes, and I'm very excited about the lineup the movies that we're coming into these next couple months.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of, like, our wives are going to be on an episode next month. I'm excited about that. My wife is super hesitant.
A Valentine's Day special that I hope that we can make a tradition.
If my wife's into it, she isn't. Well, the movie also doesn't help. She hates the movie that we're going to watch.
Yeah. We could do a different movie.
No. I love that it's this movie.
Okay.
I love, and it's one that my wife and I watched together for the first time a while ago.
Yeah.
So my wife and I have a history with this movie as well. Right. So I think I'm great. I'm happy for it. So, but yeah, I'm excited for that. We're doing our first Marvel movie this year.
That's right.
That's coming up. So just some cool things happening this year. And some cool projects that we're hoping to get in the works as well.
That's right.
By the end of 2024. So we're here. We're 2 weeks in.
Excited. We are past a fifth of the way through, but by the end of this year, we'll be past a tenth. No. Two-fifths.
Well, actually, we're negatively doing movies.
I am an idiot. Two-fifths doesn't multiply one-fifth to one-tenth, Nelson. We will be two-fifths of the way done by the end of this scholastic year.
Yes.
Not scholastic.
Financial.
Not fiscal. Fiscal. Not fiscal year. Calendar.
Mayan.
Yeah.
We do our show by the Mayan calendar. So we've actually ended 4 years ago, and we don't exist anymore. Armageddon has already happened.
All right. Join us next week for 12 Angry Men with Carrie Baldwin.
Yes. Be blessed. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
If you found value in what we discussed today, please consider leaving us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
If you have any feedback or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you.
That's right. Tell us why we're wrong.
If you want even more content and ways to engage with us and each other, check out our Patreon page.
By supporting us there, you'll get access to exclusive bonus content and help us continue to create high-quality episodes, as well as help pay for our future plans. Links to our social media, merchandise, and Patreon are in the show notes.